From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, a live exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, Gordon Walker, director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division, concludes our three-part series on homelessness. In 2005, the state of Utah approved a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness and significantly reduce overall homelessness. 8 years later, we're approximately three-quarters of the way there.
Since we started and committed to do this, we have reduced chronic homelessness by about 74%. This past year, we reduced it again by another 9%, and we are well on track to end chronic homelessness.
Also, political cornflakes with the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr, and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. Thanks for joining us for The Rundown, a news and information show where we look at emerging stories, current events, politics, and ideas. Tune in every weekday at 5 to hear conversations with local newsmakers, trailblazers, cultural entrepreneurs, and more. Later in the program, the conclusion of our three-part series on homelessness. But first, a conversation with the Salt Lake Tribune's Washington correspondent Thomas Burr on the news he's been following this week. The U.S. House passed legislation allotting more money to relocate Moab's radioactive uranium tailings. But will that money actually be distributed? I posed that and other questions to Burr, who is the author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. So, Thomas, what about the money to relocate Moab's radioactive uranium tailings? Is that going to happen?
Well, I guess not if the White House has its way. But the Moab part actually doesn't really matter to the White House, but it's several other things in the legislation that the House passed that the White House doesn't like. And we also have to consider that the Senate bill hasn't passed either. And there are some big differences between the Senate bill and the House bill. It's always says one of those things in Washington, it's a slow process, and we'll see how it shakes out. But one of the big things is, in Moab, as your listeners obviously know, there's a lot of radioactive tailings that are right next to the Colorado River, and they've been in this big process for a while to get those moved. But as always with budget cuts, there's never enough money, and they've only been able to do it for about 9 months of the year. Congressman Chaffetz is trying to make that a year-round process so that they don't have to stop in the winter months. They can keep moving those and get the project moving faster. But again, we'll see how in the end this works, because the White House has said that it's going to veto the House bill if it were to stand. The Senate doesn't include more money for Moab tailings. There's also the Central Utah Project that's involved here, and the White House isn't happy about how the House bill handles the Central Utah Project. So there are a lot of moving parts in this one, so I don't think people at Moab should celebrate just yet.
Got it. So, Thomas, members of Congress are split over the NSA's surveillance techniques, but the issue's also making for some unlikely bedfellows. Can you tell us about that?
You know, this is one of those things where you kind of have to think of the political spectrum as more of a circle than a straight line. In the circle of the political spectrum, sometimes the left actually meets the right. And the NSA, privacy, liberty, those kind of things bring people together who are not often friends on other issues. You have Mike Lee, who's working with Ron Wyden, Jason Chaffetz, who's working with Peter Welch of Vermont. These kind of guys who are often not on the same sides on votes are actually co-sponsoring bills that would try to get rid of some of the surveillance programs, or at least bring more oversight to those kind of programs that Americans have learned about in the last couple of months. On the other side, there's always the middle ground people who are not necessarily going to try to change what the NSA is doing. Senator Orrin Hatch, for example, said he knew about the NSA programs and supports them, believes there's plenty of oversight there, as do the ranking and chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, and Saxby Chambliss. So it is kind of interesting to see how on different issues you actually get people who may not ideologically agree on a lot of things, but can actually come together on a couple things that they can find common ground with.
Wow. So, and finally, in other news, Thomas, immigration reform is still a hot topic in Washington. Where does it stand now?
Well, you know, Congress has punted the immigration issue for like 30 years now, since the last round of amnesty in 1986. And I think there's some thinking on Capitol Hill now. Why not kick the can down the road a bit more? As it stands now, the Senate, of course, passed its legislation, bipartisan legislation, with a good margin of victory. And that was the hope, was that that would kind of force the House to actually move something on its side. But the House Republicans are not happy with the Senate bill. They're not even going to bring up the Senate bill. They're going to try to do a kind of a several different measure approach, where the House, the first thing it's going to do this month is try to pass some kind of border enforcement only legislation, where, you know, it kicks up the effort to more border patrol, more fencing, those kind of things on the border. And then they want to do another vote separately on legalizing those immigrants who are here, or at least creating some kind of second tier citizenship where they, you know, may not be U.S. citizens, but they can legally work here. The question becomes then is, if Republicans get their border patrol, border enforcement legislation, what's the incentive for them to vote for anything to deal with the 11, 12 million immigrants who are here in the country? So that's what we're looking at the moment. And of course, we don't know how they're going to even vote on the border enforcement bill. There are some people some Republicans who don't want to vote on any immigration legislation, because they think then the Senate might try to conference and take control of whatever they do pass. So, you know, again, this is one of those things Congress has been debating for so long, and it doesn't look like we're going to get a quick wrap-up anytime soon.
Thomas Burr, thanks for joining us today again on KCPW.
Thank you, Roger.
Thomas Burr is a Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes. We speak with Burr weekly, and there's a link to Political Cornflakes on our website, kcpw.org. You're listening to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay with us. Now on The Rundown, the final in our three-part series on homelessness. Because of its prevalence today, you might think that homelessness has always been a feature of American society. But the truth is, up until the 1980s, widespread homelessness didn't exist in America. Today, we speak with Gordon Walker, director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division, to hear about Utah's ongoing efforts to end chronic homelessness in the state. So first off, what does the Housing and Community Development Division do? What is your mission?
We work in many areas, particularly with low-income housing. We build housing. We work with in many social areas, for example, with the homeless. And also one of the big areas that we do is in rural Utah. We administer the Permanent Community Impact Fund, which provides infrastructure in rural Utah. We like to kid about the fact that if you've seen anything new in rural Utah, we probably financed it.
So, Gordon, 8 years ago, Utah adopted a policy to end chronic homelessness and reduce overall homelessness. What is the initiative, and where did the idea come from?
The initiative came when I came with the state. We looked at what we can do. I've followed homelessness for many years at the federal level and then also here. And when I came, I looked at what impact could we actually have. At the same time, there was significant research being done across the country into a model called Housing First. And what we determined was that if we were to adopt these principles, we should be successful. At the time, we didn't know whether we could do it. We didn't have the resources. No one really has resources to do all social needs. But the fact was is that we started at it and began and one at a time. Research showed that this made economic sense and that it was actually cheaper to provide housing than to leave people on the street in a homeless condition. You'll notice that we limited it to chronic homeless. And chronic homeless are those that have been homeless for longer than a year, for those or who have had four episodes in 3 years of homelessness. Generally speaking, there is a debilitating condition associated with chronic homelessness, being alcoholism, drug abuse, or mental illness. And as a result of that, it's not just enough to provide housing. What we have to do is we provide supportive services, case management. So any person that we provide housing for that is a chronically homeless individual, we also provide case management to help them with their debilitating condition so that hopefully they will eventually be able to reassimilate into society if that's at all possible.
When you get somebody into a home, do they stay in a home?
Actually, this has been a very successful program. In the beginning, when we built the first apartment complex, where we took 100 of the most difficult persons in the population and gave them each a one-bedroom apartment, some people in the community said, well, people will move here for that. If you build it, they will come. And I always ask them, if you had your choice on the fourth Wednesday of January, which is when we actually do our count of individuals, would you choose to be in San Diego or would you choose to be in Salt Lake? And there's always silence because most rational people on the fourth Wednesday of January would love to be in San Diego where it's much, much warmer.
That's true.
People do not come. In fact, we find that whom we are serving is really a local population.
Aside from the social benefits, why is this good public policy? Can you tell me about the financials of this plan?
The cost of housing an individual is about $12,000 a year. The cost of leaving them on the street, the cost to society, is in excess of $20,000 a year. And so what we have done is that we have created a model or implemented a model that is economic and the cost benefits are very, very great. Now, so every time when I present to the legislature, I always present it as a business model,
right,
that this is a cost savings. But in actuality, it's a people model. It's a humanitarian model. And so we're very excited about the success. Utah, since we started 8 years ago, and committed to do this, we have reduced chronic homelessness by about 74%. This past year, we reduced it again by another 9%. And we are well on track to end chronic homelessness within the 10 years that we allotted ourselves. We're really the only state organized as a state that is doing it to this level. And we fully anticipate that we will be successful in doing this. Now, when we say that we will end chronic homelessness, what we are saying is that we will offer to all individuals, each individual that we identify as being chronically homeless through the definitions as supplied by the federal government, that we will provide them the opportunity to be housed. We do have people, not a lot, but some, that just don't want to be housed for whatever their reason is. Do we ask only once? No. We ask them regularly because we have identified these individuals and we continually, through our partners, not just the state, this is such a collaborative effort between the state providing direction, philosophy, funding resources, but we have nonprofit partners that actually do the work, and the kudos go to them because they are the ones that have actually done it. They are the ones who are identifying the individuals and continually asking, come on home.
So what is the homeless population of the United States, and what's the homeless population of Utah?
In the United States, on a reasonably regular basis, the total is around 750,000. You're going to find that throughout the year, a lot of homeless are not homeless long. For example, families in homelessness, the actual family in homelessness in this state spends 26 days. Hmm. It's a very short term because we have a system set up. They come in, they identify themselves, we get them housed because we have other tools and mechanisms to do that. Here in the state, our overall homelessness is about 3,200. We started with just shy of 2,000 chronically homeless. We're down below 300 now. We know the individuals. We know the people by name. Even my own family says, well, why can't you help this person? I says, we've offered this person housing many times. Mm. The person chooses not to have permanent supportive housing.
You know, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts as to why there doesn't seem to be a drop in the illegal, the camps in the area, the transient camps. Are those the people who are continually rejecting these services?
They may or but they may not be, because some folks are doing it for other reasons. And quite frankly, for the housing that we offer, there are certain rules. It's for the individual. It's not for a group in a relationship. Someone may want to have a dog, and that's not part of what we're worried about. We're worried about the individual. We're worried about the people getting health care. We're worried about them having decent, safe, and affordable housing. And so that, again, is part of other people's choice. We will not in any way, shape, or form force anyone to have housing.
That reminds me, and this may be anachronism or mythology, I don't know, but I remember reading that there were communities that would basically give homeless people a free ride out of town, a bus ticket to somewhere else, or they would actually physically move them. Is there any truth to that?
Actually, there's a lot of truth to that.
Really?
The press would say Utah is sending their homeless out for the Olympics. That was not true. We do know that Las Vegas buys their people a one-way trip. And it's not mythology, because communities would go out and for health or safety or public policy, whatever the reasons were in a city, they would move encampments. I can think of some places in California that very specifically did that. I mean, they were organized with their own governments and everything. And that's way beyond what we're looking at. We're looking at the chronic that have such a debilitating condition that they're just hanging on with their life, whether, you know, with the alcoholism or the drugs,
right,
or the mental illness. I mean, mentally ill people, you know, struggle the hardest. They're the ones that's not a self-inflicted problem. That's just not simple.
And I know that alcoholism and addiction are considered illnesses.
It's become that.
Yeah. So finally, Gordon, the effective zero chronic homelessness of veterans in Utah was recently reached. What does that mean, and how was that achieved?
What that means is that the chronically homeless veterans are a subset of our chronically homeless population. We've worked very hard to work with programs that have come from the federal government. The Veterans Administration has been very helpful in providing what are known as Veterans Assistant VASH vouchers, or Veterans Administration Supportive Housing vouchers, geared specifically for veterans. That and building some housing, a new property at the VA Center, Valor House for 72 units, and also Freedom Landing, which is out on North Temple, for 110 individual beds. Between that and focusing on who is chronically homeless, what we have right now is we have more beds available for veterans, chronically homeless individuals, than we do chronically homeless individuals. So in essence, it's effectively zero. Now, the reason there's a difference is that in the new facility, the Valor House, it takes a little bit of time to fill out the paperwork and get everybody certified and everything, and that's slowly happening. So when we announced that, we knew that by the time all the paperwork's processed, the veterans homeless, chronically homeless individuals would have been properly housed if they chose to be.
So, Gordon, have you told President Obama yet? Because he set a goal to end it in the country by 2015.
Well, actually, yes.
Oh, wow.
Indirectly. Secretary Sean Donovan was here a year and a half ago and toured one of our facilities. And when he started the tour, I told him, I said, well, we'd like you to come when we end chronic homelessness. And he looked at me like, yeah, yeah. By the end of the tour, and when he saw the commitment of all the individuals, and we had a press conference featuring Governor Herbert and Secretary Donovan, he was convinced and he actually committed that he would come. So he's on notice. And as you know, Secretary Shinseki of the Veterans Administration was here probably 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, and toured the Valor House. And he spent 40 minutes just speaking one-on-one with three chronically homeless individuals. He really cares.
Wow.
He really does care. So between those individuals, yes, the message has gone to President Obama through his secretaries. In many ways, the state of Utah is out among other states teaching them some of the best practices. The federal government really wants us to be successful because up until now, even the federal government didn't believe that this was a reasonable goal. But what we are doing is providing the actuality, the truth, that yes, it can be done if you focus your resources. Is it easy? No. It takes a terrific collaboration among all different groups within the state to make this work.
Gordon Walker, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for this great discussion today.
Thank you very much.
That was Gordon Walker, Director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division. You can hear that interview, as well as the others in our three-part series on homelessness, at kcpw.org. And that's our show for this Friday. On Monday, tune in at 5 to hear about Mapping Salt Lake City, a web project that aims to tie stories to neighborhoods, led by University of Utah professor Paisley Rechtal. The Rundown was produced today by Lauren Colucci. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us today for The Rundown from KCPW. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.